From the very start, W.J. Dogan has held his help to lofty standards. In a 1927 article published in Hord's Dairyman titled, "What I Am Doing on My Farm to Solve the Labor Problem," he writes, "I require men of high quality. They must be intelligent, of clean morals, loyal to their employer, and efficient. The farm requires men of intelligence because they have to be independent workers. They must take a job and carry it through to completion. They must be clean in morals and in person because they handle the most delicate and most easily contaminated of food. They must be efficient because there is no place on a farm for a drone or a shirk. I am able to keep men of this high standard. Many of my men are college graduates. All are men of alert intelligence. Even during the war, I held to my ideals and had enough men to carry on." From a 1927 article written by Grandpa. And when a potential employee is interviewed, standing on the red rug before Grandpa's desk in the big house, the agreement is not consummated until he signs a card saying that he does not drink, smoke, or swear. Over the years, the farm has a remarkable procession of employees. Although with human frailties, they are in most instances honest, conscientious, hardworking, clean living. Several, like DeWitt Griffiths, and some of the milkmen, never move on to other jobs, but remain with the farm their entire working lives. Uncle Pat, though, once says to his brother, when they're talking about early gallants, "There have to be occasional snakes in the garden, you know," Daddy responds, "not to mention the slugs and cutterworms." Jackie has heard stories about workers who could be classified thus. Workers before her time. Others, she's been a witness. She asks Uncle Pat. She asks Mother and Daddy. She keeps her ears open. Eventually, she compiles a list. A man is caught smoking in the barn and dismissed. Another keeps a bottle hidden in a rumble seat. At its discovery, he too is let go. Swearers are harder to apprehend, for Grandpa can't hear them. One once takes glee in using foul language in Grandpa's presence. Mr. Griffiths and others are shocked, more by the insult to Grandpa than by the language itself. They tell Grandma, and the man receives a tongue-lashing he'll never forget. It's remarkable that Joan and Patsy, Jackie and Craig, grow up on a busy farm peopled by a spectrum of workers, yet aren't aware of the more obscene expletives of the language until they hear them at school. Pilfering at the gas pump occurs now and then, one spate by the teenage son of a farmhand. The boys drive across the field and up the lane from the pasture so they won't be noticed coming onto the place. But Ralph Anderson notices, and Daddy deducts the price of the gas from the worker's paycheck. The boys also substitute new tires from the farm for their own worn ones. Daddy discovers this, too, and makes them bring the tires back. There's some thievery of dairy products, even though Grandpa and Daddy's policies are generous. Milk returned from the route is free for the drinking. Men who live away from the place can even take it home. These same teenagers, until they are apprehended, switch the fresh milk and free day-old milk in the cooler and carry home the fresh. Daddy catches and fires an employee who, in his car, his own car, is plying a milk route after work with milk stolen from the dairy cooler, some 50 quarts a day. Another, who has a small farm and a few cows of his own, puts the raw milk into Dogan bottles and peddles them on his route at a lower price to certain favored customers. He then pockets the revenue. A rare helper at Grandma's or Mother's carries off produce in a large purse or shopping bag. One who had previously made off with blueberries, horse blankets, and a device for bottling root beer, goes too far when she tries to smuggle a watermelon under her coat. There are certainly thieves who are never spotted. Willie Morcombe is one. In 1929, he left the farm, Jackie learns, and headed west. The herdsman, Claire Matthews, is happy to see him back, for Willis has been sparking Claire's wife. Several years later, Morcombe writes that while employed, he stole $500 from Daddy Dogan. Now he's got religion and been born again. He encloses $50 and will send the rest as soon as he can. Well, he never sends another nickel, yet Grandma and Grandpa correspond with him over the years, and on a trip to Colorado are entertained royally at his ranch in the mountains. Perhaps Grandpa figures he has to collect his debt in trade. At least one employee regularly filches tools and supplies. Daddy is aware but doesn't say anything, for the man is needed on the farm, and his pilfering is not hurting the business too much. During World War II, there's a new route man who juggles his figures to his advantage and pockets the difference. He's caught, leaves the farm, makes restitution. Grandpa and Daddy don't call the law. Of the sexual trespasses, most must be known only to the parties involved. But the advances to teenaged Esther by O.J. Miller and Walter Lake are found out, and Floyd Peters apprehended climbing across the roof and into Esther's bedroom. He's fired on the spot. Bobby Emmert, age 17, comes to the farm from a rural village up north and is seduced by a helper in the big house kitchen, Frances, a woman perhaps 10 years his senior. She herself is married to a hired man, Oscar. They live in the upstairs apartment at the Hill Farm. She leaves her husband a note on a paper bag, saying that she doesn't want him anymore. She has a new lover. He departs, but starts watching. There's a wild scene when he comes roaring into the bedroom. Bobby, breeches in hand, flees out from the window, across the porch ledge, over the canopy, and slides down the column, gathering splinters the whole way. Frances tries to salvage the situation by urging Oscar to go after Bobby and beat him up. He replies, "Blame yourself. You shouldn't go after a young boy." He disowns his wife. She turns out to be pregnant. And when the baby, perhaps Oscar's, perhaps Bobby's, is born, Frances puts her in an orphanage. When Ronald is 11, he tells Jackie, he wanders into the horse yard and glimpses the visiting brother of a barnhand doing something very odd to a pony. The scene makes him so uncomfortable that he backs away without being noticed. Uncle Pat adds that not the brother, but the barn worker himself, lay a carnal hand on him. At 9, he's ignorant of the man's intent, but wiggles away and runs. He avoids going into the barn from that day until the man leaves for other employment. There are miscellaneous incidents. A group of first-day detasselers flatten a large area of valuable hybrid seed corn to let the breeze into the middle of the field while they play cards. A pair of farmhands steal a car in town and hide it in the calf barn. A milk house worker fails to register for the draft. A farmhand beats a horse and is fired. Occasionally, a Galahad falls from grace. In his old age, Jim Howard, model herdsman in the 20s, confesses to having tied 2 cat's tails together with a length of rope and then slung the rope over a beam in the side barn. "I don't know why I did it," he says shamefacedly. I was instantly appalled and managed to shut them down before they did much harm to each other. He shakes his head in bemusement at his young self. Totally unregenerate, however, is Louis Kozelka. He comes from a poor family in Nasida, up north, and boards at the farm. Grandpa and Grandma have retired to the edge of town, and Pat Anderson is now in charge of the big house. Louis is an indifferent young man as to intelligence and working habits, but at the end of the war it's increasingly difficult to get help of any sort, so he's kept on. He goes home frequently, and though his stays are brief, he always carries two suitcases away from the farm. He courts a girl in Beloit and announces their engagement. Her family is even poorer than his. They'll be married at the Janesville courthouse, but there'll be no subsequent festivities. Neither family will be present. Louis hints broadly that they would like to be given a reception at the farm. Pat Anderson and her husband Ralph are good-hearted. So are the other farmhands, and Grandpa and Grandma, Mother and Daddy. So they all chip in to pay for a dress for the thin little bride. Pat bakes the wedding cake. Mother makes sandwiches and favors. Grandma and Grandpa buy candy and nuts. The men bring in garden flowers to decorate the dining room. There's a fruit punch in a punch bowl. A lace tablecloth is on the table. The best china and silver. Everyone contributes to the wedding present, matched sheets and pillowcases, wrapped in silver wedding bells paper, tied with a silver bow. Louis is expansively pleased with the reception, but his bride speaks only in monosyllables. Pat thinks perhaps she's embarrassed by the modest affair, or by what may be the skimpiness of her wedding rings, for she keeps her hands clasped tightly behind her. The couple moves into the vacant first-floor apartment of the big house, the southwest rooms that used to be the office. Louis's wife is rarely seen. The shades are usually pulled. There's no sign of housework being done. No sound of vacuum sweeper, no clothes flapping on the line, only rarely smells of cooking. There are noises of a dog and a cat, and the radio is on from early morning till late at night. "She must never get out of bed," observes Pat, whose ears place the radio in the bedroom. "Those wedding sheets are getting good use." But on Louis's day off, they will both issue forth, dressed in their Sunday best, and with heavy suitcases, head north for Nasida. Several months go by. Daddy has called Grandpa's attention to the suitcases. He's also told him that expensive hybrid seed corn has been disappearing from the storehouse. They both suspect Louis of stealing corn and selling it on his frequent visits home, but they're reluctant to accuse him without proof. One day after Daddy sees Louis enter his apartment from the outside door, carrying a laden gunny sack, he comes and knocks. Louis is a long time answering. When he finally does, Daddy asks if he may come in and look around. Louis wants to know why. Daddy says he wants to see the gunny sack. Louis brings it to the door. It doesn't seem as heavy now as it appeared going in, and contains a few potatoes and onions. Daddy apologizes and leaves, but not before glimpsing the state of the apartment. He worries whether he should force a cleanup. 2 days later, Louis asks Mrs. Anderson for a plumber's helper. She brings it to him. "Are you having trouble with your toilet?" she asks. Louis says he is. A day later, Pat asks if the problem is solved. Louis is noncommittal. Pat says if something's wrong, it should be fixed, and he should see Irv, the farm handyman, about it. The next day, water starts backing up in the sinks and drains of the main house. Pat goes to Ron. He seeks out Louis in the barn, goes with him to his apartment, insists on seeing the toilet. He picks his way through the darkened living room, through the darkened bedroom where Louis's wife, curled up in bed with radio blasting, with dog and cat beside her, doesn't turn her head. He enters the kitchen. Crusted dishes growing mold are piled everywhere. Dirty water in dishes brim the sink. In the narrow bathroom behind the kitchen, the toilet is gurgling and overflowing. There's water on the floor. Daddy seizes the plumber's helper and applies it vigorously, but it produces no results. Louis shrugs, returns to the barn. Daddy works and works. Finally, he gives up and fetches Irv. They cut off the water to the big house. They drain the tank and stool and remove it. With all Irv's tools, they can't get to any obstruction. Finally, Irv inserts an auger, sets it rotating, and the trouble begins to emerge. Grinding back out of the pipe come swollen corn kernels, some of them even sprouted. They work out as much corn as they can, but the auger doesn't go far enough. The pipe seems to be filled solid. They go down to the cellar. The pipe travels a long way under the floorboards, almost horizontally, before going through the foundation on its way to the septic tank. The men break the pipe and pull out corn from either direction. Outside, they dig up the pipe and break it again. They have to climb down into the tank and ream out the pipe from beneath. They have to deal with the other affected plumbing. It takes 2 days of nasty work to put things to rights. Obviously, somebody has flushed a great deal of grain down the toilet. But because of the pitch of the pipe, along with insufficient water pressure for the job, it doesn't flush through. Louis vehemently rejects all blame. He doesn't know how the corn got there. On a final trip through the gloom of the bedroom, Daddy tartly suggests to Mrs. Kozelka that she get up and clean house. She doesn't turn her head. Grandpa is angry. "You must fire that man, Ronald," he says, but Ronald doesn't. He has no one to take his place. Even bottom of the barrels are hard to come by. It takes another month and another crisis before he does. The two have departed on Louis's day off. The animals are locked in the apartment as usual. But instead of returning the next day, the pair doesn't show up. The third day, they aren't back. The animals are frantic, scratching at the doors. That night, Mrs. Anderson calls Daddy. "Ron," she says, "Louis and Jenny have been gone 3 days, and there are animals in those rooms crying. I'm worried about them. And the smell is seeping out into our living room. It's pretty bad." Daddy hurries down. He pries open a window. The stench rushing over nearly knocks him down. He climbs in to find bedlam. A dog and 3 cats are there, starved and worse, have no water. There's no cat box. Messes from many more days than 3 are spread over the floors. The apartment is a filthy shambles. Ralph Anderson and Daddy, muttering unprintable things in French, tend to the animals, while Pat retrieves a waffle iron and dishes. She takes down her own curtains from the windows, her own sheets off the bed, picks through piles of stinking laundry for towels, face cloths, pillowcases belonging to the big house. "No wonder they never hang out the wash," she exclaims. And when Louis and his wife return the next day, Daddy tells them what he thinks of people who treat animals and property as they have. He says Louis better find employment elsewhere. The two pack up and leave. Louis is in a rage. They take the dog, but abandon the cats. The farm is left with a cleanup that takes weeks. Pat uses gallons of Lysol. Layers of food and feces have to be scraped off the floors. The rugs are a total loss. The rooms must be fumigated, the walls repainted. Grandpa looks in every day or so and shakes his head. But when the job is done, the Andersons like the fresh apartment so much that they expand into it for their own use. 2 months go by. Pat goes to her seldom open jewelry box and discovers that her mother's wedding ring and her father's ruby ring, tied up in a chiffon handkerchief, have vanished. She suspects these are the rings that Ginny was hiding at the reception. 2 years go by. Ronald receives a letter. It's written on tablet paper, in pencil, and every other word is misspelled. It's from Louis Kozelka. With some difficulty, Daddy is able to read that Louis divorced his first wife, married a fine woman, has a fine baby, is farming a fine farm, and wants everyone to know that he is getting along just fine. And the letter ends with a word that is 3 times misspelled and crossed out. Finally, it's written in block letters, misspelled a fourth way, and followed by black exclamation points, whose periods slam right through the paper. Ronald puzzles over all misspellings until the word suddenly comes clear. Catastrophe. The last sentence, were it legible, reads, "But you, Ron Dogan, are a catastrophe." Daddy whoops and pockets the letter to show the family and Grandpa and the Andersons. Grandpa observes, "You always look to see where a compliment is coming from."